When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 158. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I am back in Lincolnshire to talk to farmer George Sly. George, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks. Will, and yourself?
Yeah, very, very well, thank you. Now, has anyone ever told you that your name, George Sly, sounds like a tough-talking 1950s detective who's tired of the pen pushers up at City Hall trying to tell him how to do his damn job?
No.
Just me. I don't know. I just say that sounds like a really, yeah, George Sly. Yeah. Anyway, it's meant as a compliment.
Shaken, not stirred.
Exactly. So we seem to have interviewed quite a lot of people from Lincolnshire for the podcast now. Tell us a bit about your corner of the country there.
So I'm from the Fens, so the low-lying part of Lincolnshire, not the wolds and the rolling hills that maybe most people think of. So it's all a sort of human-drained area, if you like, but with its own uniqueness, I guess is the way you put it.
So I guess that's pretty low down then, pretty close to sea level. Does that cause you any problems?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, our own farm is plus or minus a metre, so we have land.
Is it? Wow.
And some land a metre above sea level, so certainly water is our enemy, not our friend most of the time.
Yeah. I mean, we're quite low down here, but not that low down. That is, yeah, I didn't realise you were so close to sea level. Wow. So how long have the family been there?
So I believe in the 1920s was the first time our family bought land on our farm, and it's slowly sort of grown in area since then. And back in the 1920s, it was not really drained. But during the sort of between the First and Second World Wars was when drainage started to go in, and it became more arable land over just sort of summer grazing type of thing.
Okay, so you grew up there, obviously, then on the family farm. Were you sort of typical farm kid? Did you grow up sort of desperate to be a farmer?
I really enjoyed growing up on a farm, and I enjoyed being outdoors and getting muddy and playing with motorbikes and old banger cars and everything else that you do as a farm kid. Yeah. But I never really was that interested in farming itself, more being outside than actually agriculture or farming. I mean, I guess as a kid, you live in it, but you're not really aware of why it's there or what's the purpose or how hard. Or so, but yeah, no, I wouldn't change being brought up on a farm for anything.
Yeah. But did you want to be a farmer growing up or not?
No, not really. I mean, my parents always said, you know, farming would be, or go find something else or consider something else. And
yeah,
hold that against them. It's more that it's good to have a second experience in life before you come to farming, even if I didn't know I would come back to farming. But yeah, it was interesting in that way that neither myself or my sister had any real plans to come back to the family farm when we were younger. But, how it ended up.
Yeah. So what were you interested in? Where did you see your future at that stage?
I've got a very inquisitive, restless mind. So engineering and science and business really did interest me quite a lot. Certainly commerce and economics and all that sort of stuff, I used to have a real interesting. And so I was sort of quite entrepreneurial from a young age. And I don't mean to say that, like, whenever you use the word entrepreneurial, you sound like you've got a big head.
But, you sound like you're on Dragon's Den or something.
Yeah, absolutely. No. But I didn't, agriculture wasn't really of interest.
Yeah, okay. So you decided to pursue a career in engineering.
Yeah, so I sort of did maths and physics and stuff at my A levels, and then I decided to go for a degree in process engineering, which God knows why I decided to choose that. But it was sort of process engineering's to do with sort of mining, minerals, materials science, and all sorts of other things. And nothing to do with agriculture whatsoever.
Wow, okay.
I love the science around it.
Yeah, okay. So you went to university to study that?
Yeah, I went to Leeds University, albeit not for very long. I did the fun bit, so my freshers sort of lasted 7 months, and that's when I decided I was... I spent my entire harvest money that I'd made from the farm the year before on running around Leeds, having a lot of fun. But then when it came to having to sit in a lecture room, I was kind of, a little bit confused for a while as to what I was doing there after the hangover had worn off.
Yeah. So what, you decided it wasn't for you and you'd do something else?
Yeah, I remember approaching my lecturer and saying, what are my career prospects from this degree? And he said, well, you'll end up working for one of the big oil or mining companies probably. And I said, well, what does it actually mean that I'd be doing? And he said, well, probably if you went to work for BP, they would probably station you on a platform off of Aberdeen and watch computer screens. And I was like, what? I don't want to do that. So I quickly decided that wasn't for me, and had the difficult conversation with my parents that I've blown a load of money at university and I want to come home.
Yeah.
So that's what I did.
Right, okay. So was that it? Did you just go straight home or from there?
I had to make a living of some description, because I remember my dad saying to me, well, fine, but what are you going to do? And weirdly enough, I started like a bit of a share portfolio trading, or buying shares and selling shares. and I did that from home, or just on my... I came home to the farm and then I did that a little bit, and mum and dad would often wonder what the bloody hell I was doing. But and then I went to London, or a friend of mine was working in London, and I got a job working in finance in London. I was buying and selling shares. I was the tea boy, really, and I would just be putting through trades and stuff for that company. And that was a really weird, you know, to go from farm to process engineering. Yeah. Finance was quite a turbulent time and a lot of changes, but it was a great life experience working in London.
Oh, but you didn't, when you were there working in the City of London, you didn't think, well, yeah, this is where my future lies. It was enough to tell you that wasn't.
No, I mean, there was a very buzzy environment in the finance sort of house that I worked in, it was quite unbelievable, really. I actually remember on my second day that the boss walked in and said, if you do so much in commission today, or whatever it was, we'll do the Guinness challenge. And I was like, oh, God, what's this on a Tuesday? And you had to run down the fire escape 7 floors into all bar one, down a pint of Guinness, run back up and tag your teammate on the desk.
Oh, Jesus, okay.
And I was kind of thinking, is this what happens in every London finance house and bank?
It was
a bizarre experience, really. But the whole sort of morals. There was a lot of things went on there that didn't sit right with me morally, really, about how they went about trading everyone else's money. And so it just didn't really fit well with me. And so I decided after, I think it was 6 or 7 months again, that it wasn't really for me. So I then headed back to the farm.
Okay. And was there space for you in the business at the farm?
No, not really. I came home and my dad has an engineering business. No, there wasn't space. I sort of helped him out, like doing mechanical repairs to stuff that he got jobs in for, and on engines and tractors and diggers and stuff. And then did some other tractor driving work for local farms and sort of drifted a bit for a year, and then decided actually agriculture or farming is where I do want to be. And I've just got to find my own path into that, really, of which I did.
Yeah. So tell us more about that. How old were you at this stage, by the way? About 20, 21?
Yes.
Yeah. So still very young. It's not like you've been drifting for 10 years.
No. And I say that, and I mean, you know, when a lot of my other friends were just playing around, I was worried about my career, which was, yeah, probably a bit early. But so then I decided to start my own sort of engineering business on the side of my father's, and we ran out of the same sort of farmyard that we have today, and that was a very sort of, it started off slowly and then all of a sudden sort of grew quite quickly, and I didn't really expect that to happen, but I enjoyed that, and the business has changed a lot over the last 14 years. But yeah, it was all to do with agricultural engineering and making machinery and servicing machinery and selling and buying machinery. So all using some of the skills I've picked up in other stuff I've done, I guess.
Yeah. So starting a business like that at that age, like 21, that's a hell of a thing, really. Not many people do that. Looking back now, what were the advantages of being so young at that time? I guess, you know, you still got a lot of energy and drive, but what were the disadvantages as well?
Advantages, I guess you're right. I had a lot of energy. I worked some very long hours. I had a free mind, so nothing was right or wrong in that business either. I didn't know what to do. And I mean, yeah, Sometimes I look back now and think, oh my God. Yeah. But you know, you didn't know any different at the time, and so yeah. I don't have any regrets. I also was quite like very fearless, which say I'm less so today, but so it was quite, I didn't have fear to attack competitors in terms of growing the business, and so you know, I was quite aggressive in that way. So I guess that that helped me get where it is today, I suppose.
Yeah.
And disadvantages, I definitely missed out on some of that fun time when I was young, but I don't regret it because it's the way you are and it's how I am. And I sort of evolved to be there. And I didn't miss out on a lot of social life, but I definitely missed out on that sort of growing a group of friends at university and playing lots of sport, etc. I focused on work, and that, you know, you have to sacrifice some things, but overall, I wouldn't, you know, I don't have any regrets, or I wouldn't take it back as such.
No. And about that time, you also met your wife on a whirlwind holiday romance. Tell us how that happened.
I did, yeah. So we missed a little bit. I went to New Zealand to work in the South Island, right on the bottom of the South Island of New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
I worked on a dairy sheep farm. got a job through a sort of website and made good friends with the farmer's son. And later when I came back here, it was just before Christmas, and I got a phone call from him saying, did you want to go to Zermatt in Switzerland? Just get yourself on a plane. Everything else is paid for. There's a free bed in my room, and we've got the 2 weeks in Zermatt, which is a very swanky, posh ski resort. So, so of course I said yes and got on the plane on Boxing Day and said, Mum, I'm off. And away we went to Zermatt skiing. And it was actually on New Year's Eve in a bar. Will, my New Zealand friend, was talking to a girl at the bar, and it's quite a funny story because it just bought my wife a drink. He went to the toilet and I came back and sort of moved in, and that was the end. Off we went, and he came back, and there I was sat down with her, and he was like, cheers, mate. Soul of my love. So yeah, and then we went 14 years on and with a son, and I chased Rosie around London for a while, and then where she was studying. So, happy family we are today.
Brilliant. God, I love a holiday romance. So let's just talk a little bit more about the business. What kind of equipment are you selling now?
So we make no-till drills, strip tillage machines, and like customized planters with sort of quite a lot of technology on them. Everything around our business as such is about regenerative or conservation agriculture. And that's my passion. And it's also a passion of some of the team here. And so we don't really go off that plan, and it doesn't get my attention, drive and effort if it's not down that path. And so it's quite, we're a specialized manufacturer, and we don't veer off of that. We aren't big. We have 20 employees, but we export machines all over the world, from Israel to New Zealand to Turkey, Lincolnshire to, we never quite know where our machines will go, but that keeps it quite exciting, really.
Yeah, I'll bet it does. And what part of it do you enjoy the most?
I find it immensely satisfying to sort of see a problem on a farm or try to find a solution to it. So I'm not an engineer in terms of, I don't necessarily design the stuff myself, but that's looking at problems or trying to find solutions and then mechanizing that and improving efficiency or lowering fuel use or lowering fertilizer use or anything to do with that, I find really, really rewarding. I also find discussing with all our foreign customers phone and discussing their difficulties in farming and successes. And so I really enjoy that every week talking to farmers worldwide. It's a great thing that I'm lucky to be able to do.
I suppose with farmers, wherever you are in the world, you, whatever sort of country you're from, whatever climate, whatever you are, you've all automatically got something in common, haven't you? So you can always talk to them, can't you?
Yeah, exactly. It's a universal language.
And, yeah.
Farmer to farmer, it's very welcoming and very humbling generally, which is not the case in other industries. But generally, it doesn't matter where you go, sort of there's open arms and shared experience, which is something I think we forget. We're lucky to be in that community sometimes.
So. Mm-hmm. So where did the interest in regenerative or conservation ag first come from?
Until about 6 or 7 years ago, I didn't really know what that meant. And I didn't know much about the growing of crops. I knew about machines and mechanization and engineering and stuff, but I didn't know about soil. And then through traveling, the last sort of 10 years, I've traveled a lot, and particularly to more southeastern Europe or even Africa and South America, I just kept coming across things that didn't feel right or didn't look right. And I remember particularly in Romania, a contact I had showed me a sort of 10,000 hectare area that had turned to sort of a salt flat from productive soil. And I remember flying home from that and then Googling like soil health and stuff. And then I started reading about it and became quite concerned and climate change. And then I became completely obsessed with the whole subject for probably the last 5 years. And I just started reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and listening. And then just sort of became quite worried and then really made it my focus to learn more and act more and change what we do in our business. And I didn't have the farm then, but I became very passionate about it before I even had the chance to put it into our own farm, if that makes sense.
Mm. No, it does. Are you encouraged that over the last year or two, interest in regenerative agriculture or however you want to term it, conservation ag or nature-friendly farming has grown? I mean, because it's kind of the subject that's on everyone's lips at the moment, isn't it? And it's even moving out of farming circles into the mainstream, you know, with the likes of the Kiss the Ground documentary that's just come out on Netflix, for example. Do you find that encouraging?
Definitely. I mean, I find coming into sort of farming from outside of it, we can often be very influenced, like in a stereotypical way, or worried about what neighbours might think or the way we do things. And I never like to play on that because it's not nice to. And yeah. This topic of regenerative or sustainable agriculture is in all of our interests, no matter what you think or do or like. It's in all of our interests. So I think it's great. And when you see something like that on Netflix, which is, I think, the best, one of the most watched TV streaming services in the world, that's extremely powerful. And it's been so successfully viewed. But I know just from our business, the interest is just skyrocketing in regenerative agriculture. And that doesn't necessarily, I'm not saying that from the fact that we're seeing all of that, but just globally, not just in the UK, there's a huge, huge shift towards it. Some of it, I think, is from, people reading and researching and looking in the media, and others is climatic pressures where they're looking at the farm and going, you know, why am I struggling so much? And then they naturally end up learning more about why they should adopt it.
Hmm. Yeah. And you said earlier that you have a very inquisitive mind. And when you said to me, that you have a very inquisitive mind and that you want to understand something, you have to understand it all or it drives you crazy. Have you always been like that?
Yeah, I'm... My wife says I should be looked at because it's so obsessive. No, I mean, if I hear something or learn or see something and I don't understand it, it just drives me mad. So, you know, I could come in one evening and be cooking or doing something, and at the same time I'm trying to read about something that I don't understand, or I just can't let it go until I at least understand the fundamentals of something. And it becomes really invasive to my personal and work life. I could sit here in the office and not work for half a day because I have to understand something. Or I could have my time with my son and have the phone in one hand trying to read something on Google or a website. It's something I wish I could stop, but it's like built into my code, I think.
Yeah. Is that sometimes hard for the people around you? And I ask that because I do have some of those traits myself. I can sympathize a lot with that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly on my family, it's tough because I find it difficult not to escape and try and understand whatever I'm trying to understand, when actually I really don't need to take that valuable time to learn something that I could learn some other time. So it's about prioritizing your time versus battling your mind's inquisitive nature. So it's something I guess I could say I struggle with, really.
But. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a bit about the farm. How did you get back involved in the farming business itself?
So, sadly, my father farmed with my uncle, and he sadly died 3.5, 4 years ago, I guess now. And they were in a farming partnership for 30 plus years. And at that point, the farming partnership agreement was dug out of a dusty box, which was underneath 5,000 other dusty boxes. Remember what was ever written on said farming partnership agreement.
Yeah.
It basically said that the other partner had the right to buy it, buy the other one out first. And so from not really being involved in the farm at all to having 2 to 3 months to make a decision on a large borrowing and another job on top of already a very busy job, was sort of thrust in my direction. And I really didn't know what to do. But it's kind of a ring-fenced farm, and it's been built up over time by two generations. And I couldn't sit down and let that go. So I said, sort of just said yes, and then thought, I'll think about it later.
Yeah.
So I did.
Yeah, that must have been quite stressful. That's quite a high-pressure situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really tough, and many discussions in the family, and my dad never really farmed himself. He did, but he had his engineering side. So his brother used to look after the farm, and he used to do the engineering. So I really had some experience to fall back on, but not lots. And so it was really, I must say, I thought it would be a lot easier. And I'm going to say something which I think every person listening to this will probably shoot me for, but, you know, there's the non-farming folks say, oh, well, they only work 3 weeks a year. So I thought, well, how hard can this be? I take that back. I now realise you basically don't get an hour off.
Yeah. But I suppose coming into the business like that, the way you did, I guess you wouldn't have been wedded to any particular farming system. That must have been quite a big advantage, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I knew nothing other than things to do with the machines we make, but actual practical experience of farming, I had absolutely none. So I remember sort of when my cousin who used to farm it, he combined the farm, and I drove down there and all the fields were sort of stubble, and I thought, shit. Now it's my turn. What am I going to do? And I bought a spade and went and dug a hole because that's what the books tell you to do. And started looking at soil. And then, to be honest, from then I learned a lot about soil or read a lot about soil. I still don't propose to know much, but luckily the very first autumn sort of drilling campaign was fairly stress-free. After that, it's been nothing but turbulence. But so I had a reasonably easy start from a sort of weather and conditions point of view. But yeah, we made some mistakes, which are so basic, but just that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the last 3 or 4 years in farming haven't been the easiest time to come into the industry, I would say, with weather and Brexit uncertainty and everything else. Well, bloody coronavirus and everything else that's gone on. You probably could have had an easier ride.
Yeah, well, we've had like multiple floods and droughts, and I keep saying to Dad, like, is this normal? Like, I mean, we've stood Sunday morning with petrol pumps pumping water off our fields in June after 120 mils of rain. And I'm like, is this, no. I said, well, you're 77. Surely this has happened before. And he said, well, you know, 1976 or whatever it was. But yeah, so it just seems like we've had all the extreme in the last 3 years, which has been really tough.
Yeah. So from then, when you first came in and you drove down the field and you saw the stubble fields, how have you managed to change what you were doing then on the farm to what you're doing now?
I mean, we've adopted some of the principles of conservation ag or regen ag in terms of less tillage, capitalized. I mean, well, when I say decapitalized, we started with nothing. We only had a lawnmower. So we had to buy a tractor and get a drill. And literally we started with nothing but a spade and a lawnmower. So we didn't have anything to start. So we bought some equipment, but when you start from completely scratch with nothing, actually it was at a very opportune time when a lot of people were changing their systems of farming. I didn't have anything else. So we've kept it really, really lean from that point of view and used contractors and stuff. But it's been really tough, and we had a big black grass burden, and so we adopted some other cropping, and that's caused us some other problems with the weather. And so I've learned so much, and from doing my other job for 14 years, I always say this to my wife, the farm is way more stressful ever done. And so I have a lot of respect for our customers. I now realize just how stressful it is.
Have you managed to enjoy it as well, though, as stressful as it's been? Have you enjoyed it?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. It's so exciting what we've got planned the next sort of 10 to 100 years, really. And I have to take a very long-term view, and I always try to not think about the short-term pain, even if it's really tough to not let it get on top of you and to be able to sleep at night when your crop might be getting eaten or flooded or happening to it. It's tough. But long-term, it's so difficult to see it now, but I think there's so many positives ahead for farming and agriculture in the UK that it's such a cloudy view at the moment with everything going wrong. But I think there's so much positivity out there and so many people doing such good things. And we just need to try and focus more on the long term than the short term.
Yeah, I would say that it's the most exciting time I've been in farming by some distance. So when I was sort of growing up through the 90s, and I remember sort of going to my school careers advisor and saying, you know, I think I want to be a farmer, and just, you know, it was seen as like what you did if you were too stupid to do anything else, you know, and then, you know, food production was almost I don't know, no one was interested in it. And then now, you know, it's literally on the front pages of the newspaper. You know, so many people are interested in food and farming and where their food comes from. And there's so many opportunities that just weren't there a few years ago. I think it's tremendously exciting, and I tell that to any young people I speak to.
Definitely. And actually what you said just then about, you know, people who farm are the people that couldn't do something else. And that was definitely what I thought when I was young. And sort of mum and dad said, go and see if you want to do anything else. It was kind of like, you know, oh, well, if he fails at all of that, he can come home to the farm. But and I don't mean that, don't want that to sound negative on my parents, but it's the opportunities today are huge. And for young people involved in agriculture is, I'm not old enough to say that historically, but I just think it's such a great time.
Definitely. So let's talk about trees and the future of the farm and agroforestry. First of all, perhaps just before we get into your plans there, explain what is agroforestry to people who might not know, non-farmers maybe, and why is interest in it growing amongst farmers?
So agroforestry is the practice of growing trees with arable crops, or in another light, silver pasture is trees with grass and livestock. So in its very simple form, it is just trees in a field, generally in a straight line, but they can also be in a circle or a curve. And then you crop annual crops in between the tree rows. And that, in its simplest form, that is agroforestry.
So where did you first hear about it?
Well, when we took the farm, I looked at sort of all the different... I remember Googling stuff like farming practices or ways of farming, or... And then I you know, you go across all these different sites of from Africa to wherever it might be. And I came across agroforestry on the internet and then ordered some books. And then I contacted a guy, or now the late Martin Wolf from Suffolk, a little place called Wakelands Agroforestry. And I emailed Martin and I said, I'm a sort of farmer's son with no idea what I'm doing. Could I come and see what you're doing? And he said, sure, and sort of welcomed me with open arms. And I went there on a sort of sunny late spring day. And I think his agroforestry system's probably 20 or 30 years old.
Wow.
And they have like a sort of wooden glass barn, converted barn in front of the trees. And it was just like paradise. there was just trees and animals and insects. And most importantly, there was people working with their hands. You know, we had lunch together. Everybody comes off the fields and has lunch. And I remembered that when I was really young, I remembered that being the case on our own farm, Boy, where we had five or six guys and they all used to sit around in a circle and have lunch together and spend time and blah, 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 blah. And it just all felt right to me. Mm. But taking it from this warm, fuzzy feeling that I felt this is where humans are supposed to be into something commercial, that's taken 5 or 6 years to scratch my head, lose some hair, read a lot of books. Try and make a plan and convince my father that putting trees in the fens is a good idea. Which is,
Well, it has been done before in the fens, though, with former Rock and Roll Farmer guest Steve Briggs, though. I presume you've been.
Exactly. And sorry, I haven't mentioned Steve, but I also visited Steve.
Yeah.
And I met Steve's Nuffield, which was probably one of the most inspiring things I've read to get me into agroforestry. So Steve and what he does is hugely inspiring for others to do the same.
Yeah, for sure. It remains one of my favorite interviews, actually. And I saw Steve speak last year at Groundswell about agroforestry. And it is tremendously exciting. So tell us what your plans are for the farm. How are you initially going to go about it?
So we're starting off with one field, although this year we've applied to go into mid-tier. So providing that's successful, we've kind of laid out a total of three fields to begin with, but we've kind of got capacity to even increase that in the five-year mid-tier plan.
So that's an environmental stewardship plan. Yeah.
Sorry, yes. Mid-tier is an environmental stewardship plan, whereby, first of all, on the farm, we're going to plant nearly 8.5 kilometres of hedging. There's basically no hedges on our farm. There's one or two. We're going to put hedges around a lot of the fields, and the hedges will also have trees interspaced with them. And that's a long-term plan for wind control, the wind speed down, and create a microclimate on the farm. So that was the first sort of part of planning the agroforestry system, was what's the biggest environmental risk to me planting any kind of fruiting tree? And that was, you know, cold winds at high speed. So part of mid-tier is that we've got a grant to plant the hedges, or we should get a grant to plant the hedges surrounding trees. Then after that, we've also got some stewardship strips or flower strips, which we've laid out on 27 to 30 metre alleys in the field. So will actually be paid for flower-rich grasses underneath the tree canopy in strips. So they've already been drilled in the field. So now we have them set up to do some planting this winter. And so in the first field, every 27 metres, there is a tree row. And so we've got a 3-metre tree strip, if you like, and then a 24-metre arable cropping system in between, which we are 24 metre now, so it doesn't change. Over time, I'll probably try some wider rows than that. It's such a long-term thing with so little data that we're going to basically be a bit of an R&D plot ourselves on that, and it's very difficult not to because we don't know what's right or wrong yet.
So you do plan to do the whole farm like this, the whole farm?
Yeah, there's a lot to consider, especially with drainage as well. But overall, I'm going to plant every field that is suitable to have trees planted in it. We've got a few odd-shaped fields which just won't. Doesn't make sense, and we'll probably put those to keep them cropping or put them to pasture. It'll probably take me, I'm 35 now, I would say if we do the whole farm, I'll be at least, probably 45 by the time the last field gets planted. And then that will long see me out.
Yeah, and this has big benefits for the soil as well, for the soil health.
Yeah, I mean, I've read and talked to so many people, and you know, you get a lot of negative feedbacks about trees and how they will interact with crops, and, and people saying that, you know, they'll steal the water from the crop and how they interact. And I can't tell you how much time I've spent reading about the species that I've selected and how they'll interact with annual crops and how they might benefit or hinder and what we might be able to do to stop that. And even if they do hinder an annual crop or another part of the farming system, how we can take advantage of that rather than seeing the problem, how we can profit and benefit from it. But living roots in the soil on a perennial basis is, there's so much evidence towards soil improvements, and our soil is extremely exhausted. So it's really tired, and it's a silt clay. And the less we can do with it every year annually if anything, it's going to be a benefit than a hindrance. And I'm not so worried about our biggest enemy here is water, but I'm convinced that the trees will help with drainage, not in the long run. I might be proven wrong in the short term, but I'm confident in the long run it's the right thing to do.
I mean, that does make sense. And agroforestry, it's not a new idea, is it? It has been around for a long, long time, hasn't it?
No, I mean, it's the same with everything in farming. It's all quite cyclical. But if you actually go back, I mean, first of all, in our area, if you go back nearly 1,000 years, a lot of the species we're going to plant were native there anyway. So it's not like I'm bucking the sort of trend there. But no, farmers, you know, if you look globally, forest gardening and agroforestry have been, you know, they're 1,000 years old plus. So nothing
new. What trees are you going to plant?
So we're starting off, the main sort of income will be from nut crops. So we're going to plant fruiting walnuts, which will be English. We'll try a couple of black walnuts, but they have problems with interacting with annual crops. But so walnut, and that will be interspaced with alder, silver birch, and cherry. So instead of having rows of walnuts, which from a financial output, you would all day long just put monocrop walnuts in a field. The alder, birch, and cherry offer little like financial return compared to the walnuts. But it's been a long plan and a lot of research into what could happen in the climate. We had a climate study done for the farm and where it might be in 2030, 40, 50, 60. and see what species would work together. And so, just for example, alder is there to fix nitrogen. Walnuts really love nitrogen, and I don't want to put synthetic nitrogen on the walnuts. I kind of don't want to get them hooked on it from an early age. And then birch and cherry have numerous benefits for insect life, birds, and birch, of course, has many other uses with sap and its leaves. And so every tree we plant, I've got ideas as to what we could do with some of the products, even if it's not, for example, a cherry, it might not actually be with the fruit, but there's numerous things we could extract from the trees to give a financial return. And on top of that, we will have quite a high percentage of hazel. It will suit our soil. It will sort of deal with the wet and dry periods. And nuts are such a superfood, both, you know, the grams, if you, 30 grams of nuts a day gives you a high percentage of so many important nutrition that we need. And so that's why we're focusing on nuts. And one of the other reasons is that I don't want to become a slave to it too quickly. So harvesting nuts and storing them and drying them is not that dissimilar to combining grain. In fact, that you have to take them from the tree, put warm air through them, and then you can store them and sort of sell them at your own convenience. Whereas if, for example, we're planting 10,000 acres of apples, I would have one hell of a job to try and do all of that in what is a few days, really.
Yeah.
There's a lot of thought behind that as well.
Yeah. So when, it's obviously a considerable investment, when will you start seeing return? I guess the trees take how many years? I mean, that must be one of the biggest challenges for this system, I suppose, and what would put a lot of farmers off.
Well, there is basically very little investment. So I will not pay for a single tree. The Woodland Trust will be paying for our trees. And they have a huge budget with all the climate change pledges and everything. A lot of big corporations are giving money to the Woodland Trust, and then the Woodland Trust to find people like me who will put trees in the ground. So the actual capital budget, we have done some, we've laid some water pipe and a couple of drainage pipes in the field to start with, just so that we've got water available if we have a really dry spring.
And stuff
like that. So there is some investment, but I've had this conversation numerous times, and the investment that I'm putting in even four fields of nuts is like a tenth of the cost of a new combine.
So
relatively it's quite low.
Okay, so how do you plan to market the nuts when they come off? What are your long-term plans?
So before deciding on that, I contacted a number of companies, or first of all, like wholesale nut sellers, some London sort of higher end London shops like and Whole Foods and that's those sort of people, Riverford, Abel and Cole, the veg box people, and just said, you know, if I have British grown sort of agroecological nuts that we can either crack and put in a bag for you, or, and I'm not saying necessarily we'll do that ourselves, but would you be interested? And I'm yet to call anyone that's not like, We love the idea. There's nobody doing it. Tell the story. They all want a story. They all want to know why you've done it. They want to know about your family. They want to know the reasons you've done it for, and they want to be able to tell that story to the consumer. And they're almost more interested in the story than they are the product. So it's been really encouraging to hear nothing but positive feedback on that. And so I'm going to produce, even when we grow our agroforestry, we'll also do some berries and some fruit alongside the nuts. But I'm not planning, if walnuts and hazelnut become a really good part of our business, I'm not going to put the whole farm into walnut and hazel, because I'll found that same trap of greed, if that makes sense. So, but no, there's huge markets for it. As long as it's small volume, with a story, I'm not too worried about that.
Yeah. How do you harvest them? Is it all with a bucket and a stepladder, or is it a bit more automated than that?
Well, on one hand, I really like the idea of hand harvesting.
Yeah.
The fact that I really would like to get more local people involved in our farm and have it more a community farm than the Sly's big land holding down our particular road.
Yeah.
But I've been careful to make sure that everything we plant in both its spacing and width and access can be mechanized. So there's a lot of nut harvesting machines that you can buy from Eastern Europe or Turkey or other places like that where they grow most of the nuts. So you can just walk along it, well, drive along and shake the tree and then vacuum them up, or you can shake the tree onto an apron and then it goes into a bin. And then likely we will take that back, clean them and crack them, which is also not a particularly expensive piece of machinery. And it will take us probably a week to process all of the harvest to have them cracked and dried. What we do from there on is a little bit undecided yet. When we nuts into other products, or, you know, that's where I would like other people to get involved to form sort of spin-offs from it, if that makes sense.
As interest in it grows, and no doubt when people hear this podcast, people will stampede to you to get advice, but as it grows, do you think there's scope to work with other farmers who are farming agroforestry?
Absolutely. That's my long-term goal or mission to achieve would be to, first of all, we've applied for a grant to build like a research innovation kind of like business center type thing, where not only universities, schools, colleges could come and show the kids the agroforestry and learn more about it, but also other people who might want to do other things related to what we're doing on the farm could come and use the center to grow their own ideas. But in terms of the actual growing of the products and the system and the story and the farming principles and practices, I would like to try and set up a co-op where, if, for example, a neighbour of mine thinks I'm barking mad now, but then in 5 years round to wanting to maybe do a field with us, or that's a shared thing. So I'm not greedy, and I don't work for money generally, but I would like to share that so that if we make it a success, other farmers can come on and say, for example, that was somebody like yourself in Wales, or someone in Scotland, or someone further afield. Mm. The cooperative, one thing I think we really lack in farming is marketing. And yet we're so susceptible to marketing from huge corporations, and yet we're really not doing it ourselves. And that's because you don't necessarily have the skill set or the training to do that. But the good thing about a co-op for agroforestry farms would be that you can pull those resources to have some of those skill sets in your control, and where you can approach different outlets for your products. That's what I would like to do, is form a co-op where other farms can join. And I would love to see that spin off, and I don't necessarily want to sit at the top of it, but that would be my passion to see that.
So when do the first trees go in the ground?
Well, that's supposed to happen next month. However, I might have to eat my words, because due to COVID, weather conditions and everything else, believe it or not, getting hazel trees of the specific varieties I want is incredibly difficult. I cannot find, or the nurseries can't get the stock. So we will do some planting, but that will have to be, I won't have a whole field this winter because I just can't get the stock. And trees is, with all this planting for climate pledges, it's incredibly difficult to get tree stock at the moment.
I'll bet. Yeah. Do you, I think I know the answer to this already, but I'm going to ask you anyway. The environmental benefits of this, is that important to you in terms of future generations? I mean, you have a young son. I mean, I think about it a lot because my kids are becoming very environmentally aware, and I'd hate them to say to me in 25 years' time, "Dad, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you do more on your farm for the environment?"
Yeah, I think one of the things people say sometimes is, "What will it do to the value of your farm?" And we have a mortgage, a substantial mortgage to pay off on the farm. And if I go and put some trees on that, I did ring HSBC and say, you know, "If I stick some trees in this field, are you going to have a problem?" and they said, well no, not necessarily. But why I'm talking about the value of the farm is, first of all, I don't plan to sell it. So its value is irrelevant to me other than the mortgage that we have. And secondly, I'm trying to think where in 2040, when my son might be sort of coming into the business, or if he wants to, what will humanity, or what will the farming, what will people be looking for? And a really diverse, beautiful, what I hope, landscape that mimics nature will not only increase its value, but it will have so many opportunities for other for other things. And from a climate point of view, I mean, that's something I find really troubling, is climate change, because I struggle to find positive outlooks for it. But sequestering carbon is a huge thing. I'm not a huge believer that carbon sequestration to offset keeping planes in the air or dirty power stations running is a good thing. But to see my son have a future on the farm, what I'm doing, that is entirely why I'm doing it, really. That's for him, and to see that there'll be something resilient when he's, you know, in 20, 30 years' time. And when you look at 20, 30 years' time, what they're talking about in terms of climate change, I wouldn't want to be on a very bare monocrop annual system in 2050. I would want to have something far more diverse to ensure that the farm is profitable. So.
Yeah. Has this helped with conversations about succession as well? Succession is such a difficult subject on farms, and with families who work very closely together, it can be really tricky. When you're looking to put a system in like this that you're literally planning for the next 100 years, has it helped you just to have those conversations?
Well, when my uncle died, I came in as the other partner, but it still doesn't mean when my father dies, there's myself and my sister. And before I even say about that, I would never want to fall out with her over over that. And so, money, you know, the sort of money and assets not important enough to the family member. But Dad would avoid the subject at all costs. Not that we particularly sat down every Sunday lunch and said, "Come on," but when I dropped the bomb of "This is the first field," all of a sudden he looked a bit awkward and shifted around on the chair, and then he said, "Oh well, that field's kind of going to go to your sister," and so because it's such a long term thing, that's 30, 40, 100 years, all of a sudden the doors opened and we started to discuss what he was going to plan for my sister and me. And I said to him, "Look, Dad, I don't mind what you do. Just, it would be good to know, because we have this plan." So instantly he felt more comfortable, because all of a sudden it wasn't me and my sister fighting at each other for the last acre. At a longer term plan. And he also saw that me and my sister were discussing the agroforestry. Yeah. Big interest in permaculture and everything else. And so the whole plan was revealed, and that's so much more comforting to know that that's sort of organized and there's not this fear. And it's so, I see it so much in customers as well. It's such a damaging thing to the industry. I can't emphasize enough how the business would move forward and the farms would move forward if only those discussions were had. But for us, it's been a really positive thing. I never saw that coming from planting trees in a field to Dad revealing. that's what happened.
Fantastic. Let's end the interview with the hard-hitting five questions, if you're ready for these. What is your all-time favourite song?
I found that a pretty difficult question to answer with my music traits, but I think it's The Verve, Lucky Man.
Okay, excellent choice. Love that album. Okay, brilliant. What song was playing in the bar in when you were skiing and you met your wife? Do you know?
No. Sorry, I have no idea.
Wait. Okay.
We should know that.
When the coronavirus finally ends and life returns to normal, you've already mentioned that you travel around a lot. But what's the first country that you're planning to visit?
I really like Scandinavia, so we often go there. So that's where I would go back: Norway or Finland, Denmark, one of the, or Sweden. Any of those four. That's not very decisive, but Scandinavia.
Plenty of trees there for you to go into.
Yeah, exactly.
You've mentioned that you are a vociferous reader. What's the best book you've ever read?
So the non-simple answer, I'm going to say a farming book, just because I like fiction reading as well. But I think Dirt to Soil by Gabe Brown was a really such an easy reading book, which changed a lot of my thinking. And so I know that's a bit geeky to put a farming book, but I really like that book.
No, I do as well. And I got the chance to speak to him last week at the BioFarm conference in Ireland. And I was trying my best not to fanboy and be too excited, but no, he was great. Yeah, really, really. I've read the book three times now, and I'll probably read it again. So yes, I relate. What famous historical figure would you most like to go for a beer with?
Probably Charles Darwin.
Ah, that's a good answer. Ah, really cool. Yeah, great beard. He was from not too far away from me in my local pub in the village where my kids go to school. His sister lived there, so he used to visit a lot. So he's got quite a connection to the Darwin family in this area. So yeah, great answer. And lastly, then, traditional way to finish: what is your favourite agriculture related social media account to follow?
I'm supposed to say Rock and Roll Farming, aren't I?
You really are. Did you not get the brief beforehand? Did I not put that in the notes?
I really like John Kempf. I think what he's doing with all his his background, and they're not normally using social media, but. Sure. What he's doing, I think that's really important one to follow. So.
Yeah. Do you listen to his podcast?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've started listening to it and it's really good. Okay. George, thanks so much for taking the time. I know how busy you are, so it's greatly appreciated. And good luck with everything. It's really excited, really excited to see where it all goes for you. And when it's up and running, is it all right if I come and have a look, please? I'd love to come and visit and see.
Absolutely. I insist.
That'd be fantastic. And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.